Thank you. So, first of all, if I lean away from the mic and I can't be heard at the back, please shout or do something, because this may happen, actually. Secondly, the talk is mostly for the benefit of those who don't know rather than those who know. So, in the end, if we have time, please ask questions at any level if you haven't understood anything. Having said that, I don't expect people to fully follow and understand all my sort of circumlocutory musings. So the slides are too wordy so that you can go and read them, and hopefully they make sense as text. So, what talks to follow? It's like really quite amazing talks, first of all, this morning. So I hope I can contribute something useful. So the idea here is that you've set up your model of how you think the brain works, and now you want to fit it to some real data that you have laboriously collected. And how do you do that? So this is partly practical, and it's going to introduce some notions that you actually will come across in this field, and that hopefully you'll sort of gradually work your way into. So I'm going to talk a little bit about generative computational models, just to recap what's already been said. Talk about how likely it is that behind the data our model is at work, and I'm going to talk about fitting noisy data as an example that a simple example worked out, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the place of free energy in model fitting. So it's a really lovely notion, but it is actually quite complicated, and it doesn't do much harm to hear it from different angles and recap it and sort of understand it. So then I'm going to finally use a free energy minimization model fitting method to an example of clinical research, and I'll leave you with a bit of a further reading and so on. So in general, we are interested in how the brain processes information, how it draws, for example, reasonable and versus unwarranted inferences. And we're also interested in how it does that, the sort of the nuts and bolts of the neural machinery. And so what we do is we build rigorous but superbly simplified models of computations that generate these beliefs, the behavior, and physiology. And the key thing is that if we have a model which has got a certain structure, which I'm going to denote by M, we want all our participants in a group to be described by this structure, but we have got certain parameters that characterize the individuality of each person. So the data, the probability that the data is produced, is actually a function of both the structure of a model that applies to everyone in my talk, and the parameters which are actually specific and which you want to fit. So this is what we're going to maximize in order to do this fitting. We're just going to find basically the values of theta that make the best. That maximize the probability that the data has been produced by our model. And the rest of the talk basically does that in different ways. Okay? So this probability that the data has been produced by the model is such a central concept that we actually refer to it as the model likelihood. And we write it the other way around for clarity in the purposes of modern model fitting. So as Chris mentioned, the thing that the Chris wrote it down as the right-hand side of this, so the probability of the data given the model parameters. But when we talk about it in terms of likelihood for clarity, we talk about the likelihood of the parameters given the data. So it's the same thing, but it's got an emphasis tries to make you think that what is the likelihood that the certain parameters are underlying our data, rather than the data being produced by the parameters. And the simple way to do that is to just take our generative model, calculate the parameter, calculate the probabilities that the data have been produced, and search through the different values of theta to find the one that maximizes this sum of the log likelihoods of the probabilities. We use the log of the probabilities rather than the probabilities themselves. For various reasons, some is just for convenience. It makes certain things more convenient, but also it has got a certain sort of mathematical logic to it. Some of which I'll try and give you a flavor of. Here's a little tutorial which you can try your hand out. It's a very very simple one. Of fitting a simple linear model to a set of data, and it's all got all the software there that you can try to do that. It takes you through it very nicely. Just as a flavor for what is to come, we would be interested to know a little bit more than the values that maximize this probability. So it might be that there is a certain value that maximizes probability, but actually that there's a probability distribution which is very broad, so very uncertain about what the model fit is, if the model fit is actually any good. So if any value of theta does a roughly similar job, then the fact that we found the maximum doesn't really say anything much. So I'm just going to give a simple example of this simple method, and I'm going to use a very simple task. So in this task, participants have to choose between a sure amount, which here is £4.50, or to play a lottery where this roulette spins and they get one of the amounts. My model is that our model is that the value of the roulette for people depends not only on the average amount that they're going to get from the roulette, but also on the variance and the skewness of the outcome distribution once you spin the roulette. So, for example, if the variance is too big, you're not going to like this roulette very much. This is of psychiatric importance. This is obviously a very simple sort of toy model that I'm going to use, but it's of some psychiatric importance because risk-taking may contribute to exposure to very rewarding but very risky outcomes. For example, drug-taking during adolescence. There are some very nice and much more sophisticated posters out there that elaborate on these themes that you may want to link up. It's very nice to see. We can put the research question, do adolescents have a lower risk aversion coefficient? Young people care less about how varied the outcomes are that their roulette is going to give them? Well, this is a little model. The action value Q of selecting the sure option is just the sure option, £4.50 in the previous example. The action value of choosing the gamble is the sum that I've mentioned before. So it's the expected value plus something times the variance plus something times the skew, and our fitting is actually going to try and fit this lambda v and lambda skew there, which are going to characterize each individual. And then we're going to model that the probability of actually taking one action rather than the other is a sigmoid function of the two values and the sensitivity parameter or temperature parameter tau And just the value of the sure option is just 1 minus the... the probability of choosing the poor option, the... I'll get it right in a minute. The probability of getting... of selecting the sure option is 1 minus the probability of selecting the gamble. So that's fairly sort of straightforward. And this sigmoid function that connects action values with probabilities, with policy, I am going to take to be given by this Gibbs softmax function. I haven't got a whiteboard, but this basically is a sort of an increasing function of this argument here. So if you have the Q gamble is £5 and the Q sure is £4, then you take the difference, you say, oh, there's a pound of difference in action value, and then you divide it by how much you care about a pound. So you may not care about a pound at all. So it might take £100, this would be £100, to shift your preference, in which case this would be almost zero. We had a study, and we had different age groups. Sorry, I'm going to show just two age groups. And we just looked through the values of lambda variance, lambda skew, and tau that maximizes this sum of the log likelihoods that I've mentioned before. Very straightforward. And these are histograms of the fitted values of the lambda var there. For two age groups. On the left is the older young people, and on the right is the younger young people. So once you've got that, you can, in the first instance, throw away everything that you know about where you got these numbers from, and treat these as conventional data points to do statistics. You may want to square root transform them and apply a t-test and so on and so forth. We can do that, and if we do that, we find that there's no difference between these two distributions. just again for future reference, note that we've just inferred one value of the parameters per participant. So I said this is the value for Mary and this is the value for John. That maximizes the probability that John or Mary's data has been produced. And we didn't take into advantage or consideration at all the fact that these two groups are actually two groups. There's that people that are younger may actually be more similar to other people that are younger than people who are older. This has not actually entered into the inference at all. But I am going to talk a little bit about, just tiny bit about choice variability and temperature, because it does come into a lot of things, and you may actually use it yourselves. It might be one of the first things that you use fairly generically. So the first thing to point out is that when we do these probabilistic models, the difference in choice probabilities... These probabilistic models use the difference in choice probabilities as a measure of how much people prefer one option rather than the other. So it's a very behavioral, straightforward measure. So if we have people that have got similar preferences for A and B, they must show a noise in choosing A or B in different trials. Okay, by definition of what this is like, and this is not necessarily straightforward. You could actually just ask people, or have a different task, or have some other way of finding out, of validating this notion of preference. You don't necessarily have to rely on this. But that's what we use here, and that's what we mean by preference in this case. Of what does it mean to for my preference parameter to be £100 versus £2 in the previous model? What makes a difference in my choice? So secondly, once you've actually specified your model and you've got a noise parameter in it, this is pretty much all the model has to explain things which are not described by the model itself otherwise. So if people actually, read the stars in order to make choices, the model knows nothing about that, and it'll try to absorb the things that don't particularly fit with its way of thinking about the world into that sort of variability or temperature parameters a lot of the time. So what you see in this histogram is that temperature parameter here has been constrained to be between 0 and 0.8. And there's a spike at 0.8, which probably means that there is quite a few people where this temperature estimate like sort of crashed against this artificial high boundary that we've used. And it's unclear if these people are actually using the model that we are fitting, or they're using something completely different, and this is just how the model copes with that. So I'm going to move on to introduce free energy in the context of model fitting, and actually say that I am an amateur in both sense of the word in this. So I both love it and I'm not a professional on this. So please feel free to pun. I'm going to have a go though. I'm going to try and build this concept of free energy, or this measure of free energy, from some constituents. And the first constituent is surprise or entropy. First of all, I'm going to also apologize, another caveat, I'm going to apologize for any physicists in the audience, because you may have a little bit of wondering about how exactly these sort of words using free energy and entropy here may translate to what you've actually learned in other other contexts, which it does, but it's not necessarily entirely transparent. So a successful model finds data unsurprising. So what I've said before about maximizing likelihood is the same thing as the model predicting the data. The model finds the data unsurprising. And I wasn't here, unfortunately, but I'm sure that Professor Frisson told you all about how the brain may be doing that. But here I'm just going to focus on how we do that when we fit our models. So we want a measure of surprise. And our measure of surprise, we want it to be a function of probability, because that's what we're working. And we want this measure of surprise to be additive for independent events. So if I'm surprised by A, and then I'm surprised by something completely different, which is B, I want to be able to add these up and sort of have a sum total of my surprise. H is now the surprise function, and I've just expressed this linearity there. But we know that independent events have probabilities that multiply with each other. So if this surprise is actually a function just of probability, then the arguments go like this. The probability of x1 and x2 is the probability of x1 times the probability of x2. So now if you bring together the last two lines, so you see the last two lines, the left-hand side is the same. The right-hand side has got a sum on the top and a product on the bottom. Obviously, the little h that gives the surprise as a function of probability would be applied to the two different sides of the sum. And, of course, this sort of translating sums into products is very simply the property of the log function. So we are now getting at a slightly deeper sense of why we're using these log probabilities rather than it being a matter of convenience. So the log function obviously has got a negative value for things that are less than one. So let's flip the sign so that less probable states have got a more are more surprising. And now if I have a belief distribution Q of V, describes the level of probability that I ascribe to different values of V, I can define the entropy of that distribution as the expected surprise over all the different values of V. Okay, so I have taken that log, which is inside the sum, and I have actually multiplied it by how likely I am to find this particular value of V, as one does for an expectation, like in a standard way. And this I'm going to call the entropy of the distribution. Probability distributions that are very broad are going to have a higher entropy than probabilities that distributions that are very narrow. When I know what my V is, I'm going to have a smaller entropy. Okay, and now we're getting a little bit more complicated. So this was our first ingredient, put it on the side, now second ingredient. The second ingredient is going to be not just about these underlying causes of the data, the parameters, or what I call V in the previous slide, but also about the data itself. So let's consider V being the causes that give rise to the data. And in a psychiatric example, you might think that V, for example, is the true level of depression of someone, whatever that is, but for the sake of the talk. And D might be the data that the person generated during our experiment. So now we're going to consider the generative process, or the true model of the world. We're going to think that we know how these things are produced, both how often people get depressed, and when they get depressed, or for a given level of depression, what data they would produce in our experiment. And we're going to call the probability density of those two things together the generative density or joint density, the comma between the two variables on the left-hand side of P, V, comma D is sort of denotes a joint probability. So suppose that we have gathered a certain set of data and that our beliefs about the underlying causes of this data are Q, our belief distribution V, given the data itself. So of course our belief distribution will depend on what data we got. So suppose we've got that and we've got some belief distribution about our data. Then what we're going to call energy of this belief distribution, and this is a little sort of difficult to get one's head around, is the average surprise, not this time of the distribution of the beliefs V, but of the occurrence of the data and their causes together, of that joint thing. And this is the sum. So the energy that is associated with our belief distribution Q, if we know that there is a generative density P, is a little bit like before, the expectation over Q of V. Now I have added the data in the Q of V. But now this is multiplied by the log of the joint density. Okay? Now it's a bit difficult to see why that you would call that an energy. But you may think of it a little bit as an intuition that data have high energy if that pattern that they imply can't really be generated easily by itself. So if, for example, the sake of intuition, it is possible that the molecules in this room collide with each other in a pattern that actually makes the air being denser near the top of the room and sort of less dense near the bottom of the room. However, this is a rather unlikely state of affairs to take place. I mean, it's a vanishingly unlikely state of affairs to take place, but This would be a high energy state. You can imagine sort of dense air being on top and the less dense air being at the bottom. Okay? So you see how the probability that is that the generative model of how air behaves would be quite low for such a pattern, and this pattern at the same time would have a higher energy than a more likely pattern. So why are we doing all this, and what's it got to do with model fitting? Well, we're nearly there. There's one more thing which I'm just going to tell you, and you take it that I've copied this from a sort of reputable textbook. You're not meant to understand how it's derived, but just take it for granted here, and we'll sort of go on. So there is this thing that measures the discrepancy between two distributions. So if you have two distributions, you just can't decide how far they are away from each other just by subtracting them. There's this slightly more complicated thing, which is called the divergence, which is always positive. Okay, it's like an absolute magnitude. It's not an absolute magnitude, but sort of. And this becomes zero when these two distributions are identical. Okay. And what turns out to happen is that if I have lots and lots of data, and I calculate the log probability of this data according to the true model, and I denote the average over the data now as log p of d given m, and if I have the true distribution of causes that generate these data, that are like the parameters we have that are causes that generate people's behavior, then the difference between the energy of this distribution and the entropy of this distribution, which I have sort of talked about in the last couple of slides, is equal to this measure of discrepancy between these two distributions, Q, which is my beliefs, and P, which is what's really happening, sort of thing, minus the average log probability that this data has been produced. And this difference, E minus H, we're going to call the free energy. Okay? So you can see that the free energy goes up when this discrepancy between Q and P is high, okay, and when the discrepancy between Q and P is zero, it goes to the log probability of the data. And the brilliant thing about model fitting, and this is just so exciting, it's just not true, yeah, this is amazing, it really is that we may not have a very brilliant idea about P, we may not have a very brilliant idea about Q, but as long as we adjust the posterior density Q gradually, as long as we adjust our beliefs gradually to make F smaller and smaller, we can be sure that we're getting nearer the sort of the true state of affairs of the world, so to speak, the true causes underlying our data. So, hurrah. Q of V, you're going to hear with you're going to think you're going to you may see Q of V in the literature under different terms, one of which is the approximate posterior. Okay, so there's a number we sort of people that are interested in model fitting. Now you may think that people who are interested in model fitting might be a particular breed of people, but never mind. there's a number of brilliant and almost ready-made methods that are based on minimizing this free energy that we can use to fit our models. And they come in all sorts of different flavors that are actually quite related to each other. Of course, I'm not going to spend much time on this. But the idea is, but some examples is first expectation maximization, which I'm going to use as an example in a minute. And we can use this to make, for example, use of the fact that people are organized in groups. There's the depression group and there's the healthy control group, and that these people should be like more like each other within the group than the other group. variational Bayes that I'm sure that Professor Fishton has introduced in some detail. It's very quick and efficient. Sometimes it requires some care, but it's generally a good thing. And also methods that actually sort of are more trial and error type of methods that draw lots and lots of samples from a putative belief distribution from what we think may be going on, and then sort of on the basis of anyway, they try out lots and lots of samples and gradually move towards the distribution that minimizes the free energy. And as has been said by the other lecturers so far, the brain is, this is so exciting because there's quite a close parallel between how what we are trying to do with fitting our models and what the brain may be doing in fitting its models of the world. So now I'm going to tell you about an example of model fitting using this free energy minimization method, or one of the free energy minimization methods, which is a relatively sort of simple, expectation maximization method. So what have we got? We've got a model, we've built our model, so we pretend that we know what the structure of the model is, but we don't know the parameter values that pin down the join density. Okay. So in other words, we don't know the parameters that depressed people as a group have, or healthy people as a group have. Okay. So our real goal is to find the best possible beliefs about what caused the behavior of our subjects. And so what we're going to do first is we're going to make explicit the parameters of the joint distribution. I'm going to call those capital theta, and you can think of those as the what describes a depressed group and what describes the group with social phobia, a group with healthy controls, and so on. And then we're going to admit that we don't know what caused the behavior of our problem, our participants, but we pretend that this generative density that we've just took a guess about, its parameters, can provide us with some information. So we're going to use Bayes' rule to find the posterior over the causes of the data, which is P of V given D and theta, by the conventional application of Bayes' rule. Sometimes the conventional application of Bayes' rule isn't so straightforward because it's got that denominator there, B of D given capital theta, which is a bit of a pain to calculate. But this is like, again, a sort of note. What we're then going to do is we're going to take our belief distribution about the causes to be that what we've got out of this calculation. And this is what the free energy minimization formula requires before. So this will actually make zero that divergence term between Q and P. Okay? You remember we had a divergence term which was always positive. So we're going to like shrink that to zero by doing this. But then, our generative density was pretty approximate. Okay? So now what we're going to do, we're going to admit that we don't know the form of the generative density, but pretend that we can rely on our beliefs about the causes of the data that we have actually got so far, Q of V, to refine this. So what we're going to do is keep Q of V constant, okay, and minimize the free energy expression with respect to the parameters of the joint density. Okay? So, you just... where is it? Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Where was that? So you're just going to get this expression, the equation 7, and differentiate it with respect to the parameters of p, and set that to 0. That would be a way of sort of minimizing this, keeping q constant. And then you're going to go back to the top. And you're going to go around the circle until convergence. Okay, until your estimates of the causes and the parameters actually don't change. And this is an example which some of you will be familiar with. So a group of healthy control people and currently ill people with paranoid psychosis completed an information sampling task. For those who are sort of connoisseurs in the field, I will say that these were not people with first episode psychosis. So the science of this we could discuss further, but the methodology for now. So participants had to sample information until they felt that that they were sure they had enough information to make a decision. And we had a computational model that just had two parameters, this temperature parameter that quantifies noise decision variability, and a subjective cost per step parameter of how much each piece of information that they could ask for cost them. We're going to ignore the cost now and just concentrate for the purpose of the demonstration on the temperature. Now, the thing was that the data was insufficient to infer the parameters for each participant by simple maximum likelihood estimation. So if your data is really, really good and your model is really, really good, you don't need all this stuff. You could just do the maximum likelihood estimation and get the sort of good estimates of the individual's parameters just from that. You don't need to bother with which group they belong to and what the priors are and all that. You know, your data is just rock solid, it drives your estimates. But we didn't at this point. We had only a few trials and we didn't know, we couldn't actually do a maximum likelihood estimation based at the individual level. So we used expectation maximization, and for our purposes, we're just going to look at the temperature parameter. So we wanted to know the mean temperature and the variation in temperature in each of those clinical groups. And this is what we found, that the healthy people had a much lower mean than the people with paranoid psychosis. However, this procedure that I showed you just provided point estimates for the parameters at the group level. So then we had to do something extra to find out whether these differences were significant from each other. And in this particular case, we used a bootstrap method, which I'm just going to name drop. I'm not going to tell you what it's like. But this is what it sort of showed. And you'll see on this side that the distributions of the mean temperature were well separated, and we could really make an inference about healthy people having a lower temperature, mean temperature, than the paranoid people, whereas it wasn't so clear for the variance of the temperature distribution. Okay, in conclusion, we have these probabilistic generative models in computational psychiatry. This is really central, and this gives us the probability that the data is produced by the model. We fit models just by maximizing the sum log of this for each individual. That's the most straightforward thing to do, and for many purposes it'll be perfectly okay. Or we can use more sophisticated methods, and particularly free energy minimization based methods, to take advantage of things like efficient approximations of the grouped structure of the data, of the hierarchical structure of the data, and so on. So that's sort of nearly the end of the talk. I want to acknowledge a number of people without whom I would know nothing about this topic. These include Peter Dayan, Richard Bentall, who was instrumental in the paranoid psychosis study, Quentin, who is Jonathan Williams, Reed Montague, Jiao Sigu, and Rick Adams, who I didn't put on the slide. Sorry, Rick. Carl Friston and Ray Dolan. As I have a little bit of time, I'll just take you through these resources and why I put them up. These are some key resources that you may want to read, because the slides there that I've just put up are readable and are reasonably okay, but there's obviously a lot more to the subject, and you can easily do a whole course on this sort of thing. The slides, by the way, are going to be... Jassy, the slides are going to be available, aren't they? So people can actually download the slides. Nathaniel Dorr has written a very nice article about fitting computational models to trial-by-trial data. Talks a little bit about some of the intricacies involved, for example, how parameters may trade against each other. So you may get similar model fits by having either one parameter being high and the other low, or the other way around, and what you might want to do about that. Dayan and Abbott is the sort of major textbook. I don't know if there's a new edition out or nearly out. Does anyone know? Not yet, it's really, really nice textbook. It's not very light reading. Chapter 10 talks about the use of free energy minimization in expectation maximization methods and so on. A little bit about software that you may want to use. A little out of line, I may point out once again Christoph's work. Christoph's still here, which I have used quite a bit, and I recommend for your MATLAB-based ventures. If you are not particularly wedded to MATLAB and you want to fit models with this sort of sampling methods, a fairly user-friendly package is Winbugs, which I believe still exists, and that is a nice book that I have put up there that you may want to have a look about how you use it to fit models. And last but not least, I want to mention Laplace's Daemon, which is a lovely set of Bayesian packages, both for Windows and for Linux. It says on the website that you can try and use it with Mac, but I haven't actually. So I don't know if it will work with Mac very well. But it has got some really nice methods and some rather sort of... it's sort of quite up-to-date with respect to particularly some of the sampling methods that I didn't have time to talk about. It's a little sort of hardcore as far as sort of Bayesian allegiance is concerned. So if is there a frequentist in the audience? Okay. I suspect they might actually not feel free to put their hand up. But anyway, if you're a frequentist, then maybe not. For those who want to try their hand out in sort of an expectation maximization example, this isn't specifically to do with model fitting of generative models in computational neuroscience and computational psychiatry. Specifically, it's a very simple example, and that's the URL for a sort of a two-line code that you can try some ready-made sort of a ready-made example of expectation maximization. I also put in this reference by Wynn and Bishop, and that relates to a line in Christoph's lecture that you may have sort of noticed, when he said that you may there are certain class of models called conjugate exponential models is probably all you're going to need. So some people may take issue with that, but if you do find that all you need is conjugate exponential models, this is a paper that focuses on those and describes this very beautiful and elegant method of fitting your model to the data by message passing rather than which is like passing fairly simple sort of stuff between the different belief distributions that you have, rather than evaluating sort of complex integrals. That's it. We're a little bit early.
That was fantastic, Michael. Very professional, I might add. Any questions before we have lunch?
If you do that sort of, so there's different ways of doing it. So if you're a real Bayesian, you will actually incorporate the hypothesis that the groups are different.